Welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show, a powerful antidote and elixir for the toxins of right-wing talk radio. Your humble host is on vacation. You can call in on our regular toll-free number, 888-5-PETER-B. So pick up the phone and show some love from the left coast for the man from bradblog.com, Brad Friedman.
You're going to love this. Just love it.
I got your elixirs right here.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yes, I do.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is now.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not scared in the least.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
There's no stairs here. It's an elevator.
Bounce to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Stuck back in the middle with you for one more big hour of the Peter B. Collins Show. Brad Friedman, your friendly guest host. Citizen investigative blogger, journal troublemaker, muckraker. Happy to have you here on the Peter B. Collins Show. I will be here one more day while Peter enjoys Ohio, of all places. One more hour now. One more day tomorrow. Don't miss it. We got a big, 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 big show for you tomorrow. So big that I haven't even planned it yet. Oh, brother. All right. Well, we got another hour. We're going to have John Gideon from Voters Unite, Ellen Tyson also from Voters Unite coming up in the next half of the hour. I'm going to tell you how my vote got flipped here in Los Angeles and what the L.A. County Registrar is now telling me, what the reason is that my vote, four of them, were flipped in last week's primary out here on the e-voting system made by ESNS. That's Election Systems and Software, Inc. Their voting machines don't work. Sue me. But we've been talking all day about impeachment, about habeas corpus and the Supreme Court, and I could think of no one better to talk about all of this than my next guest, former assistant U.S. attorney in San Jose and Minneapolis, author of United States v. George W. Bush, Elizabeth De La Vega. She's a veteran Justice Department attorney. She served under presidents, get this, presidents Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2. So, yeah, she knows a little bit about both public service and the law. Elizabeth, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for making time for us. Boy, I've been on a rant all day about this stuff and about what Scalia, how he tried to stop the habeas corpus. I want to talk about impeachment, but I have a question for you that came up on the blog in the chat room at bradblog.com. Agent 99 mentioned that we need to impeach Scalia. And I wondered, oh, can you impeach a Supreme Court justice? How would that work? Do you have any idea if that can actually occur somehow, and how one would go about that?
Boy, you know what? Let me put that aside for a minute and think about it, and
I wanted to give you the most difficult question at the top and catch you off guard. You're welcome. So, what did you think this week of Dennis Kucinich? These 35 articles of impeachment. I'm presuming you had a chance to. Did you get to look at all of them? They're pretty huge.
Actually, I have. I've had a chance to review them quite thoroughly, and I'm actually preparing sort of a Reader's Digest version to be posted later on. But not only did I read them, I listened to them at the entire 4.5 hours, and I thought they were riveting. And what they do is they present basically an overwhelming case of a wide-ranging set of crimes on the part of this administration, and I don't use that term lightly.
No, you don't. And you made a similar case to some of the articles that that Kucinich presented in the book U.S. v. Bush, which came how old is but a year or two ago, correct?
When U.S. v. Bush came out December 2006.
Okay, so in December 2006, you were able to make the case and put together all the facts and the details that now Kucinich brought out in his impeachment articles, that the Senate Intelligence Committee finally got around to bringing out in their Phase 2 report. What did you find that was most compelling? That may be a tough question, too. But in hearing what Kucinich had to say, what was the most compelling case, the most compelling evidence that you heard him make?
Well, I think it is really hard to identify any particular article. But what comes out of the entire reading of all 35 is that the scope of the misconduct is just huge, and it's occurred since the very beginning of this administration.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the articles of impeachment relate to activity that occurred before 9/11. We go from 9/11 right into a massive fraud to deceive the American public about the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the conduct of the war in Iraq that includes such gross waste and mismanagement. And the thing that comes out, I think, is, I forget which article it is. It might be Article 16, but and probably many of your listeners are familiar with books about this as well. But the scope of the waste and fraud in the form of money that's gone to, of course, associates, close associates of the Bush administration. So it's far more than just simple neglect. And then you have a scheme that goes all the way through, lying about Valerie Plame Wilson and covering that up and eventually pardoning Scooter Libby so as to not put themselves in a position where he could potentially testify against them. So it's the kind of thing where each individual article is serious on its own, but then when you put them all together, the sum is greater than its individual parts.
It really is. And now you spent 21 years prosecuting gangsters, white-collar criminals, serving in both Minneapolis and San Jose, and you were the branch chief and a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find parallels? And I don't know the answer. Maybe you don't. I don't know. But do you find parallels? Because I do. Between what we've seen in this administration and the way their thugs, the Republicans in this case, work, and what you saw on the Organized Crime Strike Force. And mind you, you were appointed by Reagan, right?
Right, although under I Reagan. Did not know the man personally.
Okay, but you were appointed by during the Reagan administration.
During the Reagan administration, by a Republican U.S. attorney.
Right, and so by a Republican U.S. attorney. Okay, and mm-hmm. So you're not some raging lefty here. So how do you compare what you see in this administration with what you see in organized crime? Is there any parallel there?
Oh, absolutely. And first, let me say regarding that appointment process when I was hired. It was in stark contrast to the political nature of things these days. There really was no political test, and of course I wasn't the United States attorney anyway, but mm-hmm. we heard almost nothing about politics, believe it or not, in the conduct of the business of the office.
Which is the way it had always been historically, really, up until this administration, correct?
Oh, absolutely. That's always the way it was. And but in terms of the comparison to organized crime, mm-hmm. we have a classic, really what I would call a racketeering operation headed by George W. Bush. Because there are many principles of law that apply in every criminal case, and one is that a principal is, and I mean that with the AL at the end, is mm-hmm. responsible for the acts of his subordinates and his agents. And here we have President Bush either allowing people to do things with full knowledge that they're doing it, and even when he receives notice that things are happening, you know, you mm-hmm. can give him the benefit of the doubt if you want mm-hmm. As to some of these activities. But then when the activities become public, he does nothing about them. So, and you have him using virtually every single agency of the executive branch to carry out this massive set of crimes.
So how does that parallel with racketeering, as you see it?
Well, racketeering actually requires an enterprise, uh-huh. okay? And the enterprise could be, as in the case of the indictment of George Ryan by Patrick Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. the enterprise could be a government entity. In the Ryan case, it was the state of Illinois. So here, obviously, we have an enterprise, which is the White House and the operation of the executive branch, and it requires a continuous pattern of two or more crimes that fall within a certain specified list. And the articles of impeachment lay out many crimes that fall within that list, including facts. He doesn't, Kucinich doesn't talk about the crime of mail fraud or wire fraud, but the facts he alleges certainly would satisfy the requirements of those. We have kidnapping.
Well, he meant kidnapping?
Right. We have illegal rendition.
Oh, that with the rendition. You're right. All right. Hold the thought. Elizabeth De La Vega, author of United States versus George W. Bush, former assistant U.S. attorney for 21 years, speaking about impeachment and corruption and this administration. Take a quick break here. Come back with your calls. Hang on the lines if you're there. Brad Friedman sitting in for Peter B. Collins. Stay with us. We're back in a moment. That's the main theme song from the George W. Bush White House. Speaking with Elizabeth De La Vega, author of United States v. George W. Bush. Go to Amazon.com, please, and buy it. We've got a link to it, a handy link for you at bradblog.com, right in the top story right now. She makes the case that, it's a bit of a criminal enterprise. She should know. She's a 21-year federal prosecutor who was a branch chief and member of the Organized Crime Strike Force in San Jose, Minneapolis. Elizabeth, we have a caller. Can we take a quick call with you? Do I have Elizabeth?
I'm right here.
There you are. I'm going to take a quick call. Someone wants to ask you a question, if that's
okay,
all right.
Okay, sure.
Thomas in Santa Cruz, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Brad. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hey, what's up?
My question is this. I'm very, very angry, and I think that anybody who's not angry, there's something wrong with them. And my question is this. I think it's about time to look into prosecuting people like Conyers and Pelosi for not doing their constitutional duty. What are the legal grounds for attempting something like that? Because I think it's time for that.
Wow. He's tough. Thanks, Thomas, for that for the call, for the question. Well, what do you think? It is their constitutional duty, is it not, for these folks to bring accountability and oversee the executive office?
It absolutely is. I don't know of any legal proceeding in terms of a criminal proceeding that could be brought to hold Congress people accountable in that way. I think the remedy is for them not to be reelected. That is, as far as I know, the only thing that can be done.
Right.
And the only thing we can do is continue to put pressure on Conyers. But I know he's been getting a lot of pressure, and it doesn't seem to sway him in the least.
I know, and it's quite interesting. Do you have any insight into that? Because prior to the 06 election, he was, you know, saying, bring it on, let me be the head of the judiciary and things will change. Any insight as to where he is and, you know, why? I mean, the impeachment articles are now in his committee, correct? He
correct.
Could bring those forward for investigation, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And what's most frustrating about it is that, of course, John Conyers has written a book that has actually been reprinted and has been a big seller, which actually lays out an entire case.
Exactly.
For impeachment.
Yes.
Constitution in crisis. So it is certainly a case where he has let many, many, many of his supporters down. And I think as far as why this is happening, I suppose your listeners and you would have as much insight on that as I would. It does appear that he has been certainly influenced by Nancy Pelosi, maybe with the idea that he won't be able to keep his position.
His chairmanship.
Yeah, chairmanship. So I don't know. I do think clearly that the powers that be in the Democratic Party right now mistakenly think that moving forward with impeachment will hurt them in the election, and I just think they're completely and utterly wrong.
The Senate Intelligence Committee last week unveiled their final Phase 2 report. It took years on the pre-war Iraq intelligence. They came up with some findings that I suppose had they come up with them 2, 3, 5 years ago, kind of when you came up with them in your book, maybe people would have cared. Now at this point, I mean, it's really, again, a startling list of, just to give you an idea from the statement they put out, statements and implications that President and Secretary of State suggested that Iraq and al-Qaeda had a partnership or that Iraq had provided al-Qaeda with weapons training were not substantiated by the intelligence. The President, Vice President indicated that Saddam Hussein was prepared to give weapons of mass destruction to terrorist groups, was contradicted by available intelligence information, on and on and on, making the case that these guys, they call them misstatements and misled us into war. You make this case in your book, U.S. v. Bush, that they did exactly this.
Right. Well, what I did to prepare for the book was I reviewed the Phase 1 of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report and every other report I could find, and I just did it by myself, and I compared the facts that were found to be facts in those reports with what the administration was saying, and I just prepared two timelines. You know, what did they know? What information did they have when? And that's what it took the Senate committee all these years to do.
You were able to do it by yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And build a case, because that's what you do in your book. You actually build a case to prosecute George W. Bush for these crimes.
Right, because that's what you do with any criminal prosecution when you're talking about any form of deceit. You look at, you know, what are they saying to me publicly, and what are they being told behind the scenes? That's what you do, and it's really simple, and it's really common sense, and it's really common sense to know that if someone's being told behind the scenes that Iraq has no intention of invading us whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only way they would, the only way Saddam Hussein would do that is if he were being attacked. And then they come out and over and over and over again say it's a grave and gathering danger, an imminent threat. That's a lie.
A lie, which is a word that you don't see in the media, you don't see in the Senate intelligence report. These guys lied us into war. Can you make that case?
Oh, absolutely.
It was a lie.
And that's
they
just
knew.
One example.
And And because I got to get out very quickly here to a break, Elizabeth, was there anything in that Senate Intelligence Committee report that was a surprise to you that you hadn't known about years ago?
No, not one single thing. I put all that evidence in, well, not all of it, but I put much of it in my book, and I had read all of it in the report that existed many years ago.
So it was all there. We all knew about it. Nobody's done anything about it. And now you got Dennis Kucinich trying. Nobody seems to be giving a damn.
Right.
Other than that, everything's going great. Elizabeth De La Vega, thank you so much for your time and for all you do.
Okay, well, thank you, Brad.
You bet. Author of United States v. George W. Bush, Elizabeth De La Vega. Check out this book. It's some remarkable stuff. We've got a link to it at brandblog.com. Back with John Gideon and Ellen Tyson right after this.
Are you interested in saving thousands of dollars on your medical expenses? You can travel abroad with OneWorldHealthcare.org to a top-class medical center and get quality care for a fraction of the cost. Savings of up to 75% are realistic. OneWorldHealthcare.org.
It's time for more on the Peter B. Collins Show. While your humble host is on vacation, here's Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com.
What is wrong? And the evidence is clear. I'm not alone. There are thousands of us here. This is my democracy. This is our democracy. We'll fight to keep it free. You won't go telling me.
No, you won't go telling me.
Our vote don't matter anymore.
It do.
Our vote is well worth fighting for.
It am.
Our vote is well worth fighting for.
It is indeed, and we're doing it every day here at the Brad Blog. BradBlog.com, and doing it all week long here at the Peter B. Collins Show. I am his regular Friday guest, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, where we speak about, where we report and speak quite a bit about elections and election integrity, where we can find it. A man who also speaks and reports a lot about election integrity is my good friend, John Gideon of VotersUnite.org. He reports every day on the notable voting news headlines, which you can see at BradBlog.com, at VotersUnite.org, all over the place, collecting what is really a remarkable story, a collection. While it seems as if the media is not reporting, are not reporting on these issues. In fact, they are, but they're doing it locally. On the blogs, from town to town. And when you see the case tied together, you begin to see patterns, and you connect the dots, and you see the same things happening in place after place after place in such a way that the national media just doesn't seem to get. And the national media, by way of example, has not picked up the way my vote was flipped here in Los Angeles. I'm going to tell you what the registrar of voters had to say about that. But first, let's check in with John Gideon, Voters Unite. Welcome, sir. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
How's it looking? What nightmare are we looking at in the election landscape across the country today, John Gideon?
Well, actually, I'm having some fun with the Secretary of State of Ohio. Yesterday, they put out a press release announcing that they had written a report on the results of the March primary in Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And it all went well, right? Everything,
you know,
no
everything
problems?
Went well. There were no problems, no real problems. There were small things that happened and everything, but but generally they didn't have much problem at all. Well, I thought that it would probably be a good idea for me to respond back to the senders of that press release, the press agent and I think assistant secretary of state, their press person, assistant secretary of state, and then the assistant press person. And just for giggles, I included members of the local media who have been in Ohio, who have been writing stories about election problems over
the
past few years.
They said things went well. What were you complaining about?
Well, I pointed out that 105 ballots in Butler County, Ohio, were never counted because of a problem with software and their premier voting machines, and that.
Premier, not ringing a bell. Premier,
Diebold.
Never heard of them. Diebold. Oh, Diebold. That's right. They changed their name to Premier. All right. Yeah, Diebold.
And also that even the Secretary of State went to the polls on Election Day, and she brought up a race. I think it was district attorney, and one candidate was had his name grayed out and said, with the message that he had withdrawn from the race. Well, her husband was able to vote for the person. She was not able to. It was a problem with the machine, and she had turned that over to the attorney general to do an investigation. And then the report also talks about the fact that they did, and this kudos to the state of Ohio, they did 11 counties were asked to do post-election audits, and they did. However, four counties of those 11 counties found problems so severe that they had to change results.
This was the change results in a post-election audit. They found problems, so they had to change the results
This post-election audit was done after canvassing was done, after the elections were certified, so they had to go back and change the results in certified elections.
Did it change the results of any as far as flipping any elections?
The only thing that they were allowed to check was 7% of the ballots counted in certain precincts for the presidential races only. So it would only have affected presidential races. But my point is that they did not. The report never just mentions the fact that four counties found problems. It does not say what the problems were, what how severe the problems were, what investigation was being done. Essentially, it just said, oh, there were problems, and good for us, we found a problem, and that's it.
So the system worked because we found the problem.
That's right.
You hear these reports, John Gideon, of, like you had mentioned, 150 ballots that weren't counted. I think people sometimes tend to hear these things and they go, oh, okay, well, that's not bad in a state as large as Ohio, just 150 ballots. But they don't understand that when you see something like that, it's the tip of the iceberg, because these same machines then that failed to count here or there, we may have only discovered the fact that these 150 votes weren't counted. We don't know where else we haven't noticed. And when you have this the historic turnout that we're due to have in November, anything could happen. But let me jump for a second back to Los Angeles, because which is where we're broadcasting from live today.
Sure.
Okay, in Ohio, 150 votes went uncounted. In Los Angeles, we had originally 100,000 votes that went uncounted, and after a great deal of pressure, the acting registrar of voters, Dean Logan, finally agreed to count certain ballots. So all that we ended up with was 13,000 votes that went uncounted here in L.A. County in the Super Tuesday Democratic primary. And even that, nobody cares. So it's not even a matter of, it's 150 votes. You've got 13,000, and it seems like nobody cares. But in my case, I voted last week, went to the ESNS e-voting system that they have out here intended for disabled voters. It had been broken the last primary, the Super Tuesday primary. It was broken again this time. No problem, though, because nobody asked to use it. But at the other precinct across the way in the same polling place, theirs was working. Nobody had ever used it there either, so I said I'd like to vote on it. I voted on this audio voting system intended for the blind. I went through my ballot. I voted for in 12 different races, and four of the choices that were printed out by this machine intended for the blind, four of them were printed incorrectly, and only because I'm not blind and I was able to check that paper ballot against what it, you know, should have marked down, did I discover that four votes were recorded incorrectly, which I thought was horrifying, frankly. Well, now we get word. I got an email that I will be running in full from Dean Logan, the Registrar of Voters here, explaining their cursory investigation. They quarantined the machines after I complained about it because they happen to know me, my name. Secretary of State's happen to know me, my name. I don't know if, you know, regular Joe would have had their machine quarantined that night. I got a quarantine. He came back. And what did he blame the problem on? Human error, John Gideon. Not my error, not voter error, human error. They're saying that the poll workers entered in the wrong code into the machine, and that's why I was given a ballot that was somehow printed out incorrectly, but to my ears, as I was confirming all my candidates, it sounded right, but apparently it printed wrong. Human error, John Gideon. Should we just not worry about it because, oh, it's human error? The machines work fine. We'll just blame the poll workers?
Sounds good to me. human error is always the answer. It is never the voting machines didn't work right.
Right.
There was a problem with software. There, you know, it's never the machines. It's always human error. The poor poll workers, the people who do an excellent job out there for all of us, for the voters, mm-hmm. they make sure that we're able to get out and go to the polls and do, you know, take part in elections. If it wasn't for them,
mm-hmm.
we'd all be voting by mail.
That's right. And by the way, they do it at very low cost. Many of them volunteers, very low fees, incredibly long hours. A lot of them are retired, the elderly. It just makes my blood boil, to be frank, when I hear these people blaming the poll workers. Even if it was an accident, even if they punched in the wrong code, we should not be using systems that are so easily screwed up. You know, these aren't rocket scientists. We know exactly what these machines are going to be used for. We know who's going to be running them. We know who's going to be programming them at the polls. You know, these are mission-critical systems that we have to get right. We've got one day only, and we've got people who are not, MIT graduates who have to use these things. So it irks me, John, to blame the people who are patriotic, doing their best, instead of blaming the administrators for choosing these machines in the first place, the boards of elections, for choosing systems that are so complicated that this kind of thing can happen. And by the way, had I been blind, I would have never known that I was voting for four people, four candidates that I did not want, that I did not choose.
But that's all exactly right, but it just follows along with, not only do they not care about the election workers, the people who are volunteering for them, they are their scapegoats, but mm-hmm. they also don't care about people with disabilities, the people who federal law says are supposed to be able to go to the polls and vote independently and everything. Look what happened.
That's right.
Last election, neither machine was worked. In this election, neither machine was set up, and I'll bet that the machine that you use, that they finally were able to struggle to get set up, mm-hmm. I'll bet that machine had not been tested. There had been no logic and accuracy testing or anything else done.
Nope.
And it was you're probably lucky that you got as far as you were able to.
You're right. That at least they got 8 out of my 12 votes right. Well, we're going to talk about that error rate and how that runs afoul of the federal law. But, yeah, in fact, it was, you know, the disabled that they used to say this is why we need to use these machines all over the place.
Right.
So these poor disabled, blind people, et cetera. And then it turns out that the machines don't even work for the disabled. You can't even get a wheelchair under some of them. And in the case of the one I use, the audio ballot, I said, well, this is great. But what if I had no arms here? What if I was not, quadriplegic? they said, oh, well, you'd be out of luck. So it's a scam, John.
It is. I agree.
It's a racket.
Yes.
Well, we're going to talk more about that with your partner at votersunite.org, Alan Tyson, coming up in a moment. John, we'll be back with you again tomorrow.
Good.
And your
be
voting
daily. Well,
thank you, sir. Your daily voting news will be posted to Bradblog tonight, shortly after we go off the air. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, Brad Friedman in for Peter B. Collins. We've got one last segment, and Ellen Tyson is going to tell us just how accurate my ballot was, and if it runs afoul of the federal law. Oh, I think it does. Brad Friedman here for PBC. Back in a moment.
Election reform. It sure ain't pretty. Election reform. Every state, every city. Election reform. Like Iraq or Ukraine. Election reform. In the USA.
Mm-hmm. Sing it, Shannon.
We don't believe our votes are concrete. No paper ballots. We can't compete. Gotta wonder if somebody cheats. Election reform is not a sexy thing.
No, it's
election
not.
Reform. The media swings.
Mm-hmm.
Election reform. Do they steal? Do they rob? Election reform. Gotta look to the blog.
Yeah. Look to Bradblog.com. We cover it every day. Speaking of Bradblog.com, Phil in comments at Bradblog in our open show thread writes a poem for us. Our friend Phil from up in Sacramento. ESNS voting machines stink. They never run like you think. They flip everyone's vote, yet never called broke. But everyone here knows their crap. Hey, Phil, that doesn't rhyme. Oh, wait, there's a second verse. They're easy to hack, but impossible to ever take back. Costing so much, our whole country and such. The people that buy them are whack. I agree. And we're going to find out just how much my ESNS vote that flipped in Los Angeles last week. Four out of the 12 races I voted in were flipped to people I didn't vote for. And the Los Angeles County Registrar of Voters, Acting Registrar of Voters, Dean Logan, says that it was the poll workers who punched in the wrong code when they were setting up my audio ballot. Remember, I was voting on the audio ballot machine that's for the disabled, for the blind, but apparently not for people with mobility and dexterity issues who can't use their arms. It's because you have to push buttons to do it. So 4 out of 12 ballots were votes were incorrect. There is, however, a federal law, Help America Vote Act, which tells us how many votes can be incorrect before can be counted incorrectly before a voting system is illegal and against federal law. To tell us about that, our friend Ellen Tyson, also from VotersUnite.org, who has been tracking these kind of problems, same kind of problems that I've had in other places around the country, other voting machines where we've seen similar error rates. Welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show, Ellen.
Thank you, Brad.
So what did you run the numbers on my ballot to see if it confirmed with
yes, I did. And since we started tracking the actual error rates, you'll be happy to know you're the winner.
What do you mean I'm the winner?
Well, you managed to have the highest error rate of any of the machines that we've been tracking. So
Brad Friedman of Bradblog, the guy who actually tracks these elections and reports on them, ends up having one of the worst error rates in the country on my own ballot.
Well, only the ones that we've been tracking.
That
so
we know about
we can't
that
be
we've
confident
tracked.
That it's actually the worst.
Okay.
But the ballot.
I'm number one, Ellen.
Right.
Yeah.
So the error rate that is allowed by federal law is one error in 10 million ballot lines. Now, that's not 10 million ballots, that's ballot lines. Like, for example, your ballot had about 13 races on it for a total of 35 choices that you could have made. So each one of those is a ballot line.
So if there's an office and it's got three people running for it, that would be three ballot lines,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So like, it's not unusual for a ballot in a large election to have 100 ballot lines or more. So then, really, we're talking about one ballot out of every 100,000. So One in 10 million is not excessive. The goal was to have accurate counting.
So that seems like a worthy goal.
Yeah, it is a good one. So with your ballot, with about 35 ballot lines and four errors, then that's a percentage of 11.43.
Mm-hmm.
And the allowable maximum error rate by federal law is 0.00001%. So basically, your machine registered 114 million% higher error rate than was allowed by federal law.
I rule. I'm so good. So 11.43% was the error rate on my ballot, mm-hmm. and the allowable rate is 0.00001%.
Right. And if you go to votersunite.org, I'm keeping a running table when there's an absolute definite error. So you even beat Faulkner County, which is pretty amazing. Because
Faulkner County, Arkansas, right?
Faulkner County, Arkansas. That's yeah. where the ESNS machines, yet mm-hmm. again, didn't have one of the contests on the electronic voting machine, but the voting machines counted votes in that contest anyway.
Which ended up changing another contest that they then had to flip. They had to change once they discovered the error, and the results of the election changed because
That's
of
right.
it.
That's
but
right.
I am more filled with error than they, correct?
Just barely. Theirs is 11.11. But
right.
interesting that the explanation has come to us from ESNS
mm-hmm.
Of what it was, and let's just see if you can guess what actually happened there.
In Faulkner County?
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing human error?
Wow, you're really good. Yes, human error.
See?
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk it? What do you, and I only got 30 seconds, Alan. What do you think of this when they come out? It's always human error, human error. Is it really human error? Who are the humans that are erring here in truth?
Well, yes, in truth, the programmers. But in this case,
Or the officials who choose them, Ellen. It's not just the programmers. It's the guys who say, oh, these systems are great. Let's use them.
There's a lot of human error involved in this.
Right.
But what amazes me is that somehow is supposed to be an excuse. I don't understand why that's supposed to be an excuse.
And it's because it's not. It's they're still violating the federal law when they have these kind of extraordinary error rates,
and
right?
And violating democracy. Yes.
And we ain't seen nothing yet as this train wreck heads towards November. Ellen Tyson, votersunite.org. Ellen, thank you for all that you do. Thanks for rounding up my
thank
numbers.
You.
And I hope, I hope I stay number one in this particular
topic.
That would be good. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Ellen Tyson, votersunite.org. Check them out. Much appreciated. All right, Brian, time to saddle up old Trigger because I got to hit the dusty trail for another day, but I will be back for one more day only. I want to thank Brian Urban, our engineer, and producer Katrina Rill, John Scott at Green 960, where you can grab the podcasts. Thanks to the folks at KTLK AM 1150 here in L.A., Desi Doyen producing locally, Agent 99 at the chat room, and, of course, the big man, Peter B. Collins, for allowing me to sit in. Much appreciated. We're going to be back more tomorrow and raise a bit more hell. We'll see you then.